On today's episode of The Good Word, Jay Adande joins me to discuss Anthony Davis asking for more front court help with the Lakers, trade talk around the league, and we talk about J.A.'s remembrance of Kobe Bryant. All that and much more coming up right now. Welcome to The Good Word. My name is Vincent Goodwill, senior NBA reporter for Yahoo Sports. A couple of bits of business before we get into the show today. Don't forget to subscribe to The Good Word with Goodwill on YouTube and rate and review us wherever you consume this podcast audio-wise. And today, of course, we are joined by my man, J.A. Adande of ESPN, Northwestern Medill, a bunch of other different places. We're going to get into Kobe Bryant, the death anniversary of Kobe Bryant. I want to get some curious recollections from J.A. a little later. But to start, I think we have to start with the trade deadline that's coming up. We're a little over a week away, a week and change. Anthony Davis, while you were gone, J.A., Anthony Davis did an interview with ESPN where he talked about the Lakers, wanting the Lakers to make a move. And he says, J.A., the 2019-2020 roster, the roster that had Dwight Howard and JaVale McGee, was perfectly constructed. In other words, me at the four and somebody else at the five. So when people tell you positions don't matter, Anthony Davis calls bull, right? Ain't no positionless basketball for him. But J.A., as you just think about where the Lakers are they, even if they were to throw all of their chips into the center, right, and into the center for a center, do you believe that the Lakers, where they sit now, are they a center away from being in the Oklahoma City, Memphis, Houston conversation? Or do you think that those, maybe those teams aren't that good?
I think they are that good, especially Oklahoma City. Mm-hmm. I'm so impressed by Oklahoma City. I haven't got to watch Houston quite as much, but obviously the record speaks to how much better they've been than the Lakers this season. You know, Memphis, if they stay healthy and get it together, people forget how close they were. They were a Ja Morant layup away from winning game one of that series against the Warriors, who went on to win a championship that season. Yep. And you wonder if Ja makes that layup, what the outcome of that series, and if he doesn't get hurt later on. But it's a legitimate question, though. Can Ja get all the way through the season and all the way through four rounds of the playoffs to lead them to a championship? That is a question that is far from being answered. But the short answer is, do the Lakers, is there one move that puts them up in that category? I just don't see it. And what is it with Anthony Davis? Like, you know what I think it comes down to? He's sick of being on the wrong end of them highlights with Jokic. Because the thing is, here's the problem. Yeah. You're not going to find anyone who guards Jokic any better. This is about what you're going to do about Jokic, which I'm not even so sure that's the story in the Western Conference anymore, right? But you can't guard him any better than Anthony Davis guarded him. You look at those highlights, Anthony Davis is right there, hand on the face, doing everything you're supposed to do, and Jokic just puts it way back his head and throws in a three from like 35 feet. So you find me anyone that's going to defend it, anyone that's going to do anything about it when Jokic is just doing this, throwing it from the behind his left ear.
Well, the crazy thing, J.A., is two things. One, the Lakers still have a negative point differential. With all the winning that they've done, you know, I think they were, this time last year, they were three games under 500. This year, with J.J. Redick, they're 25-18. Their first-round matchup, J.A., as the fifth-seeded Lakers, would be the fourth-seeded Denver Nuggets. They can't escape Nikola Jokic. And the crazy thing, J.A.,
just like Josh Allen can't escape Patrick Mahomes.
That's exactly what it is. Who's your daddy? Nikola Jokic is their daddy. Now, these are names that I've come up with. And for one, let's get to the point of AD talking about the 1920 Lakers that won the championship.
2020
in the
Lakers. You sound like me. And everything in the 1900s.
No, 2019-2020 Lakers.
Okay, 19. Okay, I see what you're saying.
So the thing with AD in that period of his career, or that two-month stretch, right? Empty gym, best shooting 2.5-3 months of his life. I'm not saying that you can replicate those factors even if you get him the JaVale McGee, Dwight Howard, whomever, right? But if he's not shooting as a stretch four, the way that he shot in those circumstances, J.A., I don't think this thing can work the same way that it worked then.
Well, more than that, Vinny, is so one of the reasons I didn't hear 2019 when you said it is because to me that was just 2020. That those playoffs were so far removed from the 2019 portion of the schedule I always just considered that 2020 as a standalone. And not just was whatever the shooting circumstances is, or whatever the lighting of the gym or not having fans or distractions or whatever that enabled Anthony Davis to shoot better than we've ever seen him shoot in a postseason before. I think more important was that break that LeBron James had between the end of the regular season and the resumption when we got to the summer with the bubble. And that enabled him to just sprint all the way to the finals MVP. Similarly to last summer, the summer of 2024, when LeBron got a break after the Lakers were put out early in the playoffs and then resumed at the Olympics, where he was the MVP of the Olympic tournament, coming off that nice break where he just had to play hard for 2 weeks, which he's more than capable of doing even at this age.
Right.
But can he go from now all the way through June without getting a multi-month break and play at that level? The evidence says no.
Well, he did take a break, J.A. We don't know where he was. We just knew LeBron took a break. He gone. That's what basically it was.
I mean, for a week or two. I mean, this was the unique circumstances of having a couple months off.
Yes.
And we've seen, if you give LeBron a couple months off and then just ask him to sprint for a few weeks, he still got that.
He finds the proton pack. Like, that's what it is. He finds the proton pack of energy.
Maybe Steph Curry, too, and Kevin Durant, right? This is something for all these teams to consider if they're thinking about making a move. We've seen all the signals that the Warriors, including Curry, are saying, hey, don't just mortgage the future for right now. We ain't got it. He left that part unsaid, but to me, it's implying like we ain't got it like that right
now.
Maybe I can't carry a team. You're asking me at this age to just put a team on my back for 6-8 weeks? No, that ain't happening. And the same thing with the Suns, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we hear the Suns and all this mix.
Let's finish with your team. Let's finish with the Lakers. Because here's some names that I've procured. Okay, J.A.? I've procured these names, all right? Nikola Vucevic in Chicago. Now, he's interesting because he's a stretch big himself, that you don't need AD offensively to provide the space if you have Vucevic doing that. The problem is Vooch going to be banging down? Let's just assume, right? AD would still have to defend a lot of the same guys because Vooch isn't the defender. The problem is, like with a lot of these names I'm going to bring up, Jay, is that the Lakers don't have the assets to go and get a Vucevic, Nurkic in Phoenix, who clearly knows he's on the outs there. Mitchell Robinson in New York, who's not healthy right now and is never healthy. Valanciunas in Washington, D.C., where they want picks. The Wizards want picks. The Lakers don't have picks in the current form or a surplus of picks to get them. They want Walker Kessler, but the price is too much, and the Utah Jazz say that they're not moving them. So it's like, even if a center was manna from heaven, even if it was the big mirage of water that would get the Lakers to June, J.A., they don't have anything in their war chest to go get these guys or to get a guy.
You know who's got a surplus of picks? It's funny. And you haven't heard them talked about. And I'm wondering if they should get in the mix. So, Vinny, you realize there's a scenario, it's not that far-fetched, in which not only could the Oklahoma City Thunder finish with the best record in the NBA this season, and they would have that pick, which wouldn't be that valuable at the end of the first round, but they could also get two picks in the top 15, top 20, you know, thanks to some trades and some picks that they could have coming their way. One from Philly, I think. The other one from Indy? I'm trying to remember where the other one's coming from. But they're in this position where they've got these extra picks. And if you're the Thunder, who have a great construction roster and are primed and they're young and they're talented and on the come up, but they're always got to be cognizant of finances, right? Finances are what broke up the last time they were championship contenders.
That was a choice. That was a choice, right?
But finances were what did it, right? I'm not saying they had to. And now there's more of a punishment, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it used to be, well, we don't want to pay the luxury tax. Now, if you're in that second apron, then it limits what you can do severely.
Right.
So do they need three guaranteed contracts coming in next year, if you're thinking about this team moving forward, I would think the last thing you need is three guaranteed contracts on the book, even if they're rookie scale contracts. But I don't know if you need three guaranteed contracts coming on the books. So you maybe start thinking about getting in on if there's some, clearly teams like the Lakers need picks, right? Other teams would need picks if they want to get in on the Jimmy Butler sweepstakes. You know, they have to acquire some picks. I keep wondering if Oklahoma City should get in on this.
I wonder what would they be asking for.
Well, here's what they need, right? I mean, this, again, the roster is very well constructed, and this is even without Chet Holmgren playing this season so far, or much of it. You need some age, though, right? The one thing they're missing is age. The one thing that does not qualify them to be a playoffs. I ran the numbers a few years back, and basically teams, when they win the first championship for that group, their average age of like the top six, seven players,
like in terms 28? Of
minutes, it's around 28, right? You want to be around 28. And this team last year was like the youngest team to make the playoffs. So like, they're still, I don't even think they're the 25 years old, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so sometimes you can just look at what happened with Boston when not only Horford was the first step, but then Drew Holiday, right? And then you bring up the average age of that team. Obviously, they bring more to the team than just their birth certificates and their birth years.
Right.
But that matters a lot. Guys who can bring up the average age. So if I'm them, I'm thinking back to, remember one thing I think that pushed them over the top to make the NBA Finals when they did go in, what was that, 2012, was the addition of Derek Fisher, a veteran who helped them out and helped with that age category. So I think as well as they're playing right now, as great as everything is going, you bring in a guy who doesn't even have to play that much. You don't even have to worry about him interrupting the rotation of that much, but just somebody to sit in that locker room and tell these young Bucks what's what.
And not only that, remember, that Oklahoma City team had a young coach in Scott Brooks. Yeah. This Oklahoma City team has a young coach in Mark Dagnall. And if you don't have experience, not just on the bench, like as a coach, but I think head coaching, you have to have a certain amount of experience if you don't have it on the floor. If you don't have it in either one of those spots, it's going to be really hard. Like, I don't think they're going to walk to the NBA Finals. They may get there, right? They may, especially if things stay static, but I don't think things will stay static in the Western Conference, but they may get there. We may begrudgingly wind up eating barbecue in Oklahoma City this June, right? I say begrudgingly, not because I don't like barbecue. I say it begrudgingly because what is there to do in Oklahoma City? I'm not saying, hey, let's all meet up at Staples in June. I'm not saying that either. Like, a lot of things, J.A., can happen. And Oklahoma City's in a weird space because they almost have too much of a surplus. Like, what are you willing to sacrifice for your future because of finances that you don't wind up taking away from the opportunity that you have right now? Like, they got here really quickly, almost quicker than the Kevin Durant Thunder,
right,
if you really think about it. And
right,
we thought
like
they
that,
got
that was
there
a slower
really
climb,
quick.
Right?
Yeah.
And we're presuming a little bit, like we're installing them in the finals already. But again, I feel like you can accelerate that timeline if you bring in some veterans. And you don't have just give up the picks, right? You might have to throw some people in there to make the salaries match or whatever. But, you know, I think teams would just say, hey, we care about the picks. We don't care which players you're putting in there just to make the numbers work. And you just get a veteran guy that, again, you don't have to change rotation that much. You don't have to give up guys who are in your rotation now, give up key pieces to this team. Again, I don't hear anything. This was just me speculating. This was just me thinking about what could happen, who could benefit from this, from the desperation of some teams. That it feels like the teams that most need the deal don't have the necessary assets that, say, a Miami is looking for if they want to move Jimmy Butler.
That's the crazy thing about all this, is that if people are looking at the Lakers and saying, F them picks, right? The Thunder are the prime reason why you don't say F them picks, because sooner or later, you have to pay the bill. Sooner or later, you have to look very soberly at your current roster and say, are we really a Walker Kessler away, a Jonas Valanciunas away? Like, there's a reason why Utah has stockpiled these picks and Oklahoma City has stockpiled these picks. It is capitalizing off the desperation, or capitalizing off whatever opportunity other teams see when they see you. And here's the crazy thing, Jay. Utah is down on Walker Kessler from everything that I've heard through, you know, through the scouting world, but yet the price is still very high. So I'm going to give you the outline of a player as we go to break, J.A. There's a guy who's a little bit injury prone, but is a three-level scorer, and the asking price for said player is 2 first-round picks, or at least your best young player and 1 guaranteed first-round pick. I'll tell you who that player is on the other side of this break here on The Good Word. Back here on The Good Word here with J.A. Adande. J.A., I'll be giving you a few minutes to think about it. Can you think of anybody that fits that profile?
I don't have any. I don't want to have dead air for the listeners, so we'll get
No,
right
I got
it.
You. I got you. I appreciate the quick answer. I appreciate the quick answer. The player, injury prone, a good scorer from 3 levels, and an impending free agent. Maybe I didn't give you that one. But the player is Brandon Ingram of the New Orleans Pelicans. Mm. You can get him if you've got 2 first-round picks, or if you've got your first-round pick and your next best young player. Now, he's only played 18 games this year. We know he's perpetually injured, but that team is in desperate need of a shakeup and something for his future. Ingram's also in the last year of his deal. He changed agents. That's always a precursor to, hey, get me up out of here. If put it like this, Jay, if you were the Detroit Pistons, would you say, you know what? He's a guy that would help elevate us, and he's on our timeline of, you know what? Maybe we can make this move. Ingram is 27 right now. You've got Cade Cunningham and Isaiah Stewart, Jalen Duren, and, you know, all those veterans that they brought over there to augment everything they have going on. Is that the profile of a team that you would say, let's go make a move and go get a Brandon Ingram, or would you keep your powder dry?
As high as I am, as big as I am on the age 27 factor, that's when most great players make their leap. The thing with Ingram, like, you're not bringing him in to be your star, right? It's Cade mm-hmm. Cunningham's team. Mm-hmm. And does Brandon Ingram go with that concept of fitting in seamlessly? Mm-hmm. Do you feel like you can mm-hmm. add him, especially mid-season, and ask him to fit in seamlessly? Is his type of game the type that, you know, that dribbling a lot and he's going to be ball heavy and he's not necessarily going to be looked to pass? Does that fit in seamlessly to what you're doing? So I would question that. And it reminds me, going back to when Ingram and all those guys first came to the Pelicans in a trade from the Lakers. Think about it. Ingram, Randall, Lonzo Ball, post-trade, we saw the best versions of all those guys at some point, right?
Yes.
But what did those teams have to show for it? You know, and what did the Lakers have to show for getting Anthony Davis? They won a championship. Mm-hmm. So I still think, you know, for any teams that are out there, and there aren't a lot of scenarios like that that we're hearing about where teams are wondering whether to give up a clutch of young players for a star. Mm-hmm. But whenever that situation does arise, you do it. And a lot of people are talking about the fact that the Thunder have Shai Gilgeous-Alexander for Paul George to the Clippers, and not to mention the picks, right?
Like, right,
you wouldn't do that trade straight up, even with no picks right now, right? Knowing what we know now. However, the Clippers went to the conference finals for the first time in Clipper franchise history.
Ever.
With Paul George. Right? Are you going back to Buffalo too? Yeah, I guess so, mm-hmm. right?
Ever.
First time in franchise history. With Paul, that's something that the Thunder have yet to do with Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. That could change as soon as this year.
Right.
But for now, guess what? Just in terms of what it did for the team, what the team accomplished, the Clippers actually won that trade. Would you rather be sitting here, especially with Paul George on his way to Philly now? Are you saying, are they looking like the winners now? No. But in terms of getting what they at least hoped to do or wanted to do, obviously they wanted to win a championship. And also we have to remember that it wasn't just for Paul George. Getting Paul George meant you get Kawhi Leonard.
Yeah,
I still think you do that trade again. Knowing what we know right now, today in 2025, I would still do that trade if I was the Clippers.
You have to, because of where you were as a franchise. And the anvil that Kawhi Leonard was holding over your head, whether it was real or not, of him saying, I'll just go to L.A. and play with LeBron James, even if he had no intention of really being a Laker, but he knew that was the Clippers' worst nightmare. If you don't go and get me Paul George and we come together, I'll make you another level of irrelevant. Now, J.A., you bring up Paul George. That's an interesting name. I've heard that Philly quietly could be a suitor for Jimmy Butler and a Paul George for Jimmy sort of straight up, you know, not, I don't think they make exactly the same, but theoretically it would be a Jimmy for Paul George swap. I believe I've heard this, that Joel Embiid, who still loves Jimmy Butler, is pushing for them to reacquire Jimmy Butler, knowing that Jimmy is out there. But here's the other side of that, Jay Adande. Paul George was told by management or ownership, we wouldn't trade you year one of this deal. So there are so many different iterations. I'm not saying that Joel Embiid is pushing for Paul George to be traded. I'm saying that Joel Embiid is pushing for them to acquire his buddy, Jimmy Butler. But can you even trust Joel Embiid, who can't get on the floor?
Yeah, for Jimmy Butler, is that what you'd want to sign up for? Is that where you would find your joy? You know, he wasn't wearing Philadelphia 76ers colorway shoes, right? He's wearing those Phoenix Suns colorways. He also might just want to be warm at this stage in his life, too.
Yeah.
He's been playing in Miami. He's hoping to go to Phoenix. He's got a crib out in California. Like, he might, I've been thinking about that, too. Like, you reach a point where, like, you know, warmth matters more than anything else. Like, I always thought I would be a skier at some point. Like, that was always something. You ever gone skiing, Benny? Have you
that
ever pause, gone skiing?
That, Jay, no. Your screen didn't freeze. Your screen didn't flinch. It wasn't nothing like that. I will answer this question respectfully. Are you out of your damn mind, Jay? You know good and hell well I'm not going skiing. I don't want to die.
I always thought I would. I mean, I grew up, like, you know, 2 hours away from skiing mountains in Southern California. I could see them from my, you know, the end of my street on clear winter days. And I always figured I'd get to it at some point, and I never did. And then I reached a point, like, at this stage of my life, when I have the option to go somewhere, I'm going somewhere warm. I don't want to be cold of my own volition. You know, I'm cold because I have to be, either work or whatever makes me cold. But, like, I'm not going to go on vacation somewhere that's cold and snowy. No, I want to be on a beach somewhere. So I think Jimmy Butler is at that stage of life where, like, I want to be on a beach somewhere, or at the very least, I want to be outside, you know, working on my tan, poolside or oceanside, somewhere near water in January and February. That's what I'm trying to be. So I think he's at that stage. But I just don't see. It's funny. I could. Is that what you want from Miami? Like, don't you think Miami needs to think younger? Like, are they in a right now? Your only reason you're right
Pat,
now is because you have Jimmy Butler.
Pat Riley is Jerry Jones. We crack on Jerry Jones old ass all the time for, you know, stuff that he says and then stuff that he does. Pat is, they're in the same everything. They went to high school together. I don't know if they really did go to high school together, as in high school at the same time, but this ain't Pat Riley of 1987 with the, you know, slick back black hair. This is Pat Riley that is, what, in his late 70s, J.A.?
He's almost 80, yeah. Knocking on the door at 80.
There isn't a long, he's at the stage where he's getting a statue. He's actually getting a statue in L.A.
Court is named after him, right.
You know, all of that type of stuff. So he's at that, you know, I'm getting my flowers, which I have no problem with. I'm glad we are giving the Pat Rileys of the world, the stewards of the game, their flowers. But as opposed to, as it applies, excuse me, to team building, I don't think the Heat have the stomach for a rebuild. Maybe they want picks. I've heard that they could entertain, you know, draft picks, as opposed to, okay, we need a player for player swap, because clearly this Jimmy thing has gotten out of control. Is Paul George a player that you can get? I still think I'm with you, J.A. I think Phoenix is still to play. They don't seem to have necessarily the stomach for a Bradley Beal contract, which I understand. It just doesn't feel like an easy solution.
The one that made the most sense, not that it, I perfectly agreed with it, but I could see the reasoning behind it was, you know, Butler to Phoenix with Bradley Beal ending up in Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. Like, because Milwaukee could, although I don't, Milwaukee needs more. I don't think that Bradley Beal is the more that they need, but it's something, right? It you know, gives them a little more firepower, especially we don't know what Chris Middleton is or what he can give, yikes, that whole story, right? But you know, I don't think Bradley Beal replaces Chris Middleton for them, but it could mitigate. So that one would make the most sense, but it just feels like that's cooling off a little bit, right?
I mean, let me ask you this, Jay, because you've been around the game a long time. Bradley Beal is one of these guys that he spent his best years playing irrelevant basketball for an irrelevant franchise that has never won a thing and never come close to winning a thing.
Once back in the 1970s.
When I say never won a thing, yeah, the Bullets, right? When I say never won a thing, and I conclude, I think me and you are kind of in the same wavelength. Modern NBA basketball started with Magic and Bird. And if you further it, 84 was the first year of playoff expansion, 4 playoff rounds. You got to win 16 games, or at least back then you had to win 15 games. Now with first round being expanded to 7 games, now you have to win 16 games. The attrition of the playoffs makes the NBA, to me, more modern starting in 84. But the Wizards have never won a thing in that period. Is Bradley Beal a player at this stage of his career? He's not 36, 37 years old, but with the injuries and everything else, is he a guy, Jay, that you're looking at and saying, okay, if Bradley Beal is willing to come here, we're a Bradley Beal type of player away?
No. And guess what? He wasn't the answer in Phoenix, and they got a version of him that was not significantly, but was still younger than this version right now today, right? Mm-hmm. So, yep. You know, that old philosophy, like, you're never going to be as young again as you are today. But, like, it feels like that applies even more to Bradley Beal, right?
Yeah, it does. So it, yeah.
That's part of the problem. Like, I feel like a Phoenix could be a Jimmy Butler away from mattering. Like, I feel like Milwaukee could be a Jimmy Butler away. You know, I don't feel like the 76ers are. You know, especially if you're in a position where he could be your third best player or third most important player. Mm-hmm. Wow. I mean, that's the thing. People still talk about, well, you know, he took a team to the finals. Like, I don't think he has another one of those in him. To his credit, initially, before he did it, I didn't think he was a guy that drags you to the finals.
And he had two of them in him.
Yeah. So to his credit, he exceeded those. But, like, can he exceed again at this stage? You know, that was, again, the younger version of Jimmy Butler. Like, at some point, you just have to realize and accept that the calendar is 2025. There's a lot of reasons I'm not willing to accept that. But we have to. You know, I don't want to, but we have no other choice than to accept that we're living here in January of 2025. And that's the reality, and it has a whole lot of implications. It feels like in the NBA more than other places.
I'll tell you
this,
man. Well,
not everywhere.
Not everywhere. I'll tell you this. Jimmy Butler in those 3 years, you count the bubble year and the Game 7 of the Eastern Conference Finals against Boston, where he puts a little more leg into that three. We're having the best weather NBA Finals in the history of my lifetime, Miami and San Francisco. But instead, we had to go to Boston and San Francisco. I'll never forgive
San Francisco
him for that.
In June is not great weather, by the way. Oakland might be. San Francisco in June, you can get foggy.
No. It wasn't bad, J.A. It wasn't. It was more like 70 degrees as opposed to 65. And it might have been a little windy, like one of the days, maybe like before game two or something like that. But by and large, it was a decent, you can roll your window down when you're driving your rental car weather. That's all I need. I don't need 85, 90. I ain't trying to sweat my skin off. Just give me nice June weather. And we were really close.
Vinny, you know what the cruelest thing of all is, though, right? We finally got L.A. versus Miami in the finals, and it was played in Orlando.
And it's played in Disney World.
The only L.A.-Miami finals we've ever had. We know we've been dreaming of that probably since you first started covering the NBA. I know I was all my NBA coverage career. And when it finally happened, it happened in Orlando with nobody in the building. And
nobody
very few
there.
People actually covering it.
And very That's few people so actually saw it.
That is it so, was, so cruel.
And we ain't never going to see that. Excuse my French. We ain't never going to see that shit again. All right, it will never happen again as long as we walking. All right, now a couple of quick notes to go to, and I don't think you'll be surprised at either one of these things, Jay. Zion Williamson not getting moved. I don't know if I would touch him, but I've been told from rival executives that Zion Williamson not getting moved. Julius Randle, who I think Minnesota should consider moving, is not getting moved because the Timberwolves management believes that over time, he's going to mesh himself in better with what they have. Maybe you can't get anything of value for him the way that, you know, if you turn Karl Towns into a lesser version of Karl, not into something lesser, which is Julius Randle. And then you have to trade Julius Randle and you turn him into something lesser. Mm. Essentially, you turn Karl Towns into two tiers less of a player. And I don't think that the Minnesota Timberwolves want to have that egg on their face just yet.
I think with both guys, the question isn't so much should you move them. The question is who would take them, right? At this stage. Yeah. I think it's a good time for New Orleans to explore moving Zion. I think anytime he's on the court looking good, that's when you strike and say, hey, look, Zion Williamson, he's actually playing. You want him?
Right.
But I think if I'm looking around the league, because you're bringing in Zion, like, again, you're not bringing him to be a complimentary piece, right? Like, none of these contending teams are thinking we're a Zion away at that type of contract. You know, he's going to put us over the top. A, you can't count on him being on the court, and B, you know, what can he be a complimentary player? Does his game allow for him to be a complimentary player? Right. We don't know that. We couldn't find out. So you're asking a team that, okay, who could we use Zion to be the guy on our team? And then could we trust him to be the guy? And then for Julius Randle, you have to say, all right, he's never going to take your team that far. The Timberwolves appear to be worse off for having him. Do we want to take the risk that he's going to make our team worse off the way he did for Minnesota as he gets older?
I think Julius Randle is a good player for a team that is not near the upper crust. He may make your middling team better. I don't think he makes your good team better. Just his style of play, he's bull in China shop with the ball. You know what I mean, Jay? It's not like passes on time and on target, like that sort of thing. And defensively, just simple stuff. Like, we're talking big picture basketball stuff here, but simple stuff, making the defensive rotations, making sure you're getting back on defense. That stuff chips away at a team. That's, if you're not doing that, if one person doesn't do that, Jay, that permeates through the rest of the roster, because that can lead to a three. That can lead to a fast break. That leads to giving up offensive rebounds, and people are feeling like they're being left out to dry because not everybody's on the string. And I can't say it's necessarily his fault or not his fault. This is the guy he's been his entire career, so I don't expect him to change.
Part of the question, so if I'm Minnesota, particularly if I'm Anthony Edwards, I'm not so sure I want to bail on the Julius Randle experiment quick, because if I'm Anthony Edwards, I want to take on the challenge of, can I make Julius Randle the guy? And Anthony Edwards is not the one saying this, but if Anthony Edwards is the Michael Jordan modern version, or, you know, or the Jordan light, whatever, but, you know, we've heard that comparison.
Yes, we have.
I'd be like, can I make Julius Randle a Scottie Pippen? That would be my challenge. Right. Before we had the Pippen template, Jordan really helped make Pippen. Right. And hold your Scottie Pippen takes. I know what you want to say.
I'm not saying anything.
Just hold them for right now. You get what I'm saying. I know you want to say it, but just hear me out here.
I'm keeping my mouth closed. Y'all know how I feel about this.
What I'm saying, though, right?
Yes.
I feel like. It's interesting. I was watching that Starting Five on Netflix during one of my flights recently, and there was a point on the bench when Edwards was telling Cat, hey, man, you can't be getting in foul trouble. And we know that's Karl Anthony Towns' bugaboo, but here's Anthony Edwards counseling him, and it's funny because he's the younger of the two players, experienced of the two players, and he's telling Karl Anthony Towns what to do. And so I wonder if we could get some of that guideline. I would love to hear to have them mic'd up and get that behind the scenes footage this season of him with Randle and see what those conversations are like. But, before we bail out on Randle, let's see what Edwards can do.
Why are you trying to give him what they say? The Lord gives his battles to his strongest soldiers. Anthony's like, man, why are you giving me all these battles? I'm tired. I'm fatigued.
Do you think Karl Towns can take some credit for Cat's success in New York?
Yeah, he can, but guess what? He ain't doing it with me. He doing it for them. you ever hear about the women who say that they mold a man and make a man, and next thing you know, the man leaves them for some younger version, and she ain't happy that she made a better version of you for you to be better with some other woman. She was doing that for herself and was out here making Julius Randle, making Karl Towns, a better Karl Towns for Anthony Edwards' life to be easier.
For the, making it easy for the cleanup woman.
Yeah, exactly. Come on, man.
To great Betty Wright. But, but here's the thing, though. Here's, if we gather this body of evidence, that got, I'd also, if I'm afraid of Anthony, if I'm Anthony Edwards, if Julius Randle goes somewhere else and improves the way we've seen Karl Anthony Towns, is it me?
Is it
something I did? Is it something well, I said?
I think we have more of a book on what Julius Randle is, more so than what we had on Karl Towns, right? Like, we've seen Julius Randle in different places for different teams looking like the same old Eeyore. Right, remember Winnie the Pooh, Eeyore. That's Julius Eeyore, Randle. Yeah. That's what he looks like out there. All right, I'll get back on defense tomorrow. Like, that's what it seems like. Hey, man, this is the body language. It might not be. He might be the most enthusiastic dude walking the face. It just doesn't look like it. Now, last thing before you talk about Kobe J, Golden State, they look like they are tumbling and tumbling fast. Mm. I know they have a lot of their pieces hurt. Draymond is hurt. Brandon Podziemski is hurt. Like, Podziemski wasn't having a great season. Who am I blanking on? Buddy Hield had a strong start.
Nice start and then just faded.
Stephen Curry quietly has been petering out because it's too much weight for him to carry at his age. I know what he's saying, but if they're trying to, let's say, not even compete for a championship this year, which we know they're not, but if you're trying to, like, preserve the best of the rest of Stephen Curry, don't you need to lighten his load? And by lightening his load, that's not Dennis Schroeder, God bless him.
Yeah, I didn't quite get the Schroeder acquisition. I mean, yeah, it was another, you know, another guy that can maybe create some shot, give you some more offense, which they needed, but again, you got to think both sides of the ball. And I wish more teams would look at how it seemed to adversely affect Milwaukee going from Drew Holiday to Damian Lillard, mm-hmm, right? And just mm-hmm. missing a slightly bigger, but certainly much more better defensive player. Would you compare Holiday to Lillard as a scorer? Of course not.
Right.
And, you know, and in the clutch, if you need a bucket, I'd much rather have Liv, but there's so much more to the game to that. And we saw it in Milwaukee, took a step back. And you just, I think these GMs know what they're doing. I'm not going to sit here and pretend like I know more about
navigating
the CBA and the salary cap and all the other things. And I'm as well aware of all the players out there and I've been scouting all them. No, I would never pretend that. But some things just seem basic, especially when it's been right in front of your face. When you saw the value Drew Holiday had to your team and you moved him and the team did not get better as a result. And well, when I thought of all the options out there for Golden State, Dennis Schroeder didn't seem like the solution to me.
They're just tinkering. I think it's a function of this second apron tax world that everybody's sort of getting accustomed to, the draft picks that it can cost you, the restrictions that it places on trades. Like, literally, there's less you can do with the more money you spend. Like, there's more money out there for players. It's less ways to get it. And I don't think they saw that or considered that when the NBA masterfully put together this collective bargaining agreement that protects the owners from themselves.
Was that air quotes? Right at masterfully?
Yeah, masterfully. Unintended consequences is the phrase.
I got a quick point I want to make. It's funny because I just saw this in relation to the Chiefs. I saw a graphic about teams that have three-peated or better in the modern era. But the NBA ostensibly does these things for the sake of parity, right? And mm-hmm. Adam Silver mm-hmm. has been very, very outspoken about that. And this is probably where Adam Silver and I disagree the most. And I generally believe in the direction that he's taking the NBA. And I think Adam Silver has been a good commissioner, a great commissioner mm-hmm. for the NBA. But I disagree that parity is the goal. And so we know, Vinny, and you talked about it. We talked about, you know, the heyday of the league that so many people like to talk about, whether they're an 80s guy or a 90s guy. There wasn't a whole lot of parity. It's basically three teams doing it in the 80s, maybe four. And then it was really two teams doing it, winning championships in the 90s. So in the NHL, it was one team won championships. It was the Montreal Canadiens won four straight starting in 76. Mm-hmm. And then the New York Islanders won four straight starting in 80, I think it was.
Okay.
And then the Edmonton Oilers won four out of five. And the only one they didn't win was won by the Canadiens. So basically from 76 through 87, I think, or actually through 88. From 76 through 88, you only had three champions in the NHL. And I will tell you, the NHL was a lot bigger during that stretch than it is today, just in terms of it mattered more, right? Like right. It was a bigger part of the sports discussion when there mm-hmm. were only three teams winning over a dozen years. Just like the NBA mattered more. It's funny because this stretch we've been, however many champions we've had the last few years, the last time we had that in the NBA was in the 1970s, which is hardly, no one would call that the golden era for the NBA.
Ages.
I think you referenced that not too long ago on this podcast. So, you know, the notion that the leagues that sure, it's better for the individual teams throughout the league, but for the league itself, you need that bell cow. And for mm-hmm. the TV partners, you need that bell cow, preferably a glamorous team, right? That's going to, and that's what's going to pay. Everybody's going to get paid off that TV contract. And the yep. TV contracts are big when you have a 90s Bulls or Warriors with Steph Curry, Magic, Showtime, Lakers, et cetera. That's what mm-hmm. the league needs. And so all these things that have been put in place to make that more difficult are not in the best interest of the NBA brand.
Well, I want to say this quickly, so I'm going to try to get
Rant
through
over.
This quickly. Yeah, you're right. One, fans need something to root against. They need to know who's good so I can root for them or against them. And when you have all these mid teams, by and large, like fans may care about basketball, but they don't have anything compelling to care about with you. Now, right. what works against that, JA, is now you have all these TV partners and you only, and with a balanced schedule, unless you're going to unbalance the schedule to where you have the marquee teams playing against each other more often, which takes away from fans at the gate and in home markets, then you have to do your best to make more teams feel relevant as opposed to making more teams feel excellent. Like you have a TV product to sell and you have more TV inventory to sell. The last point, Adam Silver works for the owners. I'm trying to figure out who works for the game, who works for the fans. And that is the concern that I've long had about him with the three-point revolution, with the influence of analytics, with all these other things. You've had so many teams change hands over the past 15 years that these owners have said, I want to make money and I want to win, and I want you to guarantee that. And there's no world where you can guarantee all of these things without making it so that mediocrity is rewarded. And that is where we're going to end things there. Because we got to talk about Kobe. When we come back, we're going to talk about Kobe Bryant, the great Kobe Bryant, the five-year death of his anniversary. I got a couple of curious questions to ask Jay down there in the last word. Back here on The Good Word. Time for the last word with Jay Adonde. Jay, it was the five-year death of Kobe Bryant yesterday. It doesn't seem like it's been 5 years, but it feels like in some ways it's been a year or 2 years. In some ways it feels like it's been 10 years because it's almost like the last normal week of our lives when, you know, that happened. Like there was the, if people don't remember, like that Tuesday was the debut of Zion Williamson and mm-hmm. New Orleans. Like he had missed the start of the season. I wound up going to New Orleans to see him play. I think he played against the Spurs, and he was like, oh, okay, he's here. That weekend, LeBron James and the Lakers were in Philly. LeBron had passed up Kobe on the all-time scoring list on the ABC game on Saturday night, and then he talked about what Kobe Bryant meant to him and being a young player and everything else. And then on my way back on the train from Philly to New York, where I lived in New York, that's when all hell broke loose. And then a month after that, we had COVID, and then the world has never been the same since for a number of different reasons. But Jay, it's two inflection points I want to talk about with Kobe with you with the time we have left. How much did Kobe want that 2009 final to be Lakers and Cavs? Lakers going back to the finals after 08, they had lost to the Celtics. I knew he wanted his Celtics get back. But that LeBron James 66 win Cleveland Cavaliers team, that mano y mano, that was LeBron's first MVP, and it was clear that he was coming, but he wasn't quite there yet. How much, if you even knew, how much did Kobe want that matchup for himself?
You know what's interesting? He never talked as much about LeBron and him wanting his shot at LeBron in the finals. I think he just realized early on it wasn't meant to be. So going back to LeBron's rookie year, Kobe kept getting hurt in or before they played LeBron. Like, he didn't play LeBron a lot early on head-to-head because there was always some injury that would occur right around the time, and it just took him out. And so we didn't get to see them go head-to-head a lot early on. I do know what he really wanted was another shot at the Celtics. So in 2010, when they beat Phoenix, and it's funny because he had to lie about it. So they beat Phoenix, and now they're going to play the Celtics. And everyone's like, oh, rematch with the Celtics. And he's like, man, I was just focused on beating Phoenix because all the times, you know, they beat us in the first round. I remember, I think in 06 and 07, the Suns, the Steve Nash crew, you know, they put Kobe out of the playoffs, including coming back from a 3-1 deficit that the Lakers held the advantage. So he goes into all this stuff about, I really want a revenge against Phoenix. Then after they beat the Celtics, he goes, no, it was about Boston. I really, really wanted Boston, but I couldn't have y'all talking about that. It would have hurt more if we lost to them, but like, no, I wanted Boston. You were right. You guys were right. I wanted that revenge. So he talked much more about Phoenix and about Boston than he ever lamented. I never heard him lament the chance to go against LeBron.
Do you think quietly he wanted that?
I just feel like him and LeBron were just very different, you know, and they just, they're pros, but I don't think Kobe, you notice that we never even saw them in the commercials, right? It was the puppets going against each other.
Yeah.
You know, we saw Magic and Bird go against each other in the Converse commercials back in the days in the 80s. Okay, Larry, show me what you got. But we never saw Kobe and LeBron go against each other, even though they were both Nike guys. We never even saw them on the court together in a Nike commercial. It was the puppets.
No, they weren't in a Nike commercial together. Remember, it was like a Juel Santana song. They were playing basketball in the airport hangar. It was like all of them. It was LeBron, Kobe, Paul Pierce, Rasheed Wallace. Okay,
but that wasn't. It wasn't just Kobe them two versus LeBron.
No. I was just saying the commercial came to mind.
Against each other.
In the commercial, it was a big team game, and you couldn't tell who was against who.
At one point, were they guarding each other in the commercial?
I don't think so. The images were so quick.
I think I know what you're talking about. I think I remember a commercial on that. But the fact that I don't even remember that is very hazy for me.
We remember,
if you're old enough, you remember that Magic versus Larry Converse commercial.
Absolutely.
So, Larry, I heard they made Converse weapons for last year's MVP. So, but we never got anything like that.
Yeah.
Right? So, I just don't think Kobe was as obsessed with, I know I was. Because that was the only, if you think about it, we did get Magic and Bird versus the finals.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, we got Jordan versus Barkley. You know, it's weird because there was really no huge finals matchup we wanted to see with Michael. But, you know, we got him versus Karl Malone, you know, the guy that won MVP on Michael's watch. Mm-hmm. You know, like we generally have had the matchups you could ask for in the NBA finals, but we never got Kobe versus LeBron. And I just feel like NBA history is worse off for that.
I agree. I think, and the crazy thing was, like, people who can say you bang on LeBron or whatever, that wasn't his fault that they didn't go to the finals in 09 when they lost to Orlando. Orlando had a monster in Dwight Howard.
Yeah.
And he balled. He was averaging 38, 8, and 8 that series. Let me repeat that again for y'all. 38 points, 8 rebounds, 8 assists. In the two games that Cleveland won, LeBron had the game winner in game 2. And then in game 5, I want to say he scored like the last 25 points for them to beat Orlando just to stave off elimination. Like, it wasn't his fault. But
I've never looked at the plus minus. I got to go back and look at the plus minus for that series for LeBron on and off the court because it must be insane.
Insane. Like, and the other thing with Kobe that I really want to hit on, because I feel like we've done a bad job, like we as a monolith, as a media. I feel like to some degree, Jay, we overrate older Kobe, like the Kobe we're talking about, 08, 09, 10. And we underrate young Kobe because he was in Shaquille O'Neal's shadow post that first championship. I feel like come 01, 02, 03, even though they didn't win in 03 and 04, the last 2 years of the Shaq Kobe thing, he was very much, it felt like, Shaq's equal or as close to it as anybody could be at that time.
And they would kind of take turns kind of depending on the matchup. Yeah. So you're right. What we don't talk about enough is 2001 Kobe.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that was the year that they ran off that 15-1 in the playoffs. Right. 15-1. Yeah. I think it was before 16. So that Kobe. So the first two games against Sacramento in the conference semis, Shaq goes 40-20, 40-20, right? It hadn't been done since Will. And then they go on the road, and Shaq was never that great on the road. He once told me it was because he could never get a good night's sleep in those hotel beds, which might sound like, but when you're that size.
That big, yeah.
Yeah. You know, when you, I'm sure you had custom beds at the crib that you just can't duplicate in some, you know, Hyatt or Marriott on the road, or Ritz-Carlton even.
Right.
I get it, especially now as we talk about the importance of sleep. So Shaq's road numbers usually weren't that great, but Kobe sure were. And if you look at Kobe on those road games in Sacramento,
48-16.
Oh my God. You know, some of the best Kobe numbers we've ever seen in the playoffs, right? So we don't talk like those. That felt like that game would never come on ESPN Classic. Like I can't even remember the last time I've seen it. I'm not even sure I even saw it live. I just have very little memories of that game, but I know the numbers were phenomenal, right? And so I wish we would talk about that. Yeah, you could talk about the 81 points, you know, that gets run up, especially this time of year, every year. But like that Kobe, you know, and that was the year, the next series, my favorite Kobe interaction, just the cold-bloodedness. And I tell the story before, but I'll repeat it. You know, they remember that the San Antonio Spurs were favored that year. They had home court advantage. They were higher-seeded team than the Lakers. And so the Lakers go down, and lo and behold, they win game one. Okay, you know, got a little people off guard. Like, everyone was convinced. If they had legalized gambling back then, I probably would have gone to bet on the Spurs in game two, man. It was just a given. The Spurs were going to win game two, right? And then the series was going to be on. Let's see who gets game three. And then the Lakers win game three, thanks in part to Kobe just hitting a dagger late in the game. I think Fisher misses a shot, rebound comes out, Kobe hits a straight off three that just plunges the knife into the heart of the Spurs, right? So after the game, we're walking from, this is at the old Alamo Dome, so it was a long walk from the locker room to where the bus would be, and I'm walking with Kobe. I said, "Hey, Kobe, man, I think you hit an artery with that shot." He goes, "Let him bleed." And it was so ice cold. I was like, oh my God, Kobe.
Yeah.
That's the type of assassin that he was. Just heartless and ruthless. And I mean, that little, I will never forget that exchange walking to the bus in the Alamo Dome. And to me, that was Kobe. And so, you know, you might have other thoughts. I'm sure other people, they think of Kobe. Yeah. Anyway, like when I think of Kobe, the essence of Kobe, I think of that. Actually, one little other change we have that does the one time he did mention LeBron or indicate some type of rivalry with LeBron. So really randomly, we're in Utah, and he starts telling me about this book called Good to Great. It's a business book. He's like, you should read it, you know, and he just was like espousing this book and you know, the lessons he learned from it. And then he says, "And if you tell LeBron and them about it, I'll kill you." So it was like he felt like there was so many, you know, winning secrets to be found in this that he didn't want any of his competitors to have it. So that was the one time I really heard him talk about some type of rivalry with LeBron, or, you know, really reference it at all. But yeah, it was that same, and it was in that same tone when he said, "Let him bleed." So I took him serious. So I, not a word. And I remember I asked him about it, you know, a few years later. I was like, "All right, some time has passed. Like, I would like to mention this." You know, I said, "Kobe, can I reference that book you told me about?" "No." "Okay." So I never mentioned it until after he retired. I'm like, okay. And I really, probably his last couple of years when he wasn't competing for championships, I probably could have referenced it. But like, I wanted to make sure he was retired before I told anybody what book it was.
It's funny that you say that, because you like just how maniacal of a competitor he was. I felt like early on in Kobe's career, and of course, I'm from a huge distance, right? I'm younger. I'm not in the business. I'm not even a college student at this point, to some degree. I felt like Kobe was doing an imitation of Michael Jordan, like in the way that he played, in the way that he talked, like even just like the way that he walked and the way that he moved. It just felt like he was doing an imitation. I've always been curious from the standpoint of, when did that stop? Like, was there a moment? Because I know you had to look at it like, you're doing a Michael imitation and it becomes ingrained in your head. Was there ever a point where you're like, oh, he's being himself now? Whatever that thing is, he's no longer doing the imitation. He's Kobe Bryant now.
Yeah, probably mid-2000s, you know, probably once he had his, you know, three championships, you know, and he'd established himself. And he reached a point, I think the key for him was once he recognized and accepted the fact that there was at least a whole generation of people, you know, kind of my generation, really any generation that had grown up with Michael or had covered Michael professionally, you know, didn't necessarily grow up with him. But, you know, you had this whole age range, a vast age range that was never, no matter what Kobe did, they were never going to put him ahead of Michael. Mm-hmm. And so he recognized that. And at that point, he started discouraging the comparisons with Michael. And he would kind of roll his eyes whenever somebody tried to make, you know, and he's like, well, never, I'm not like, you know. So I'd say that's kind of mid. So it was around the time when he was putting up those big numbers. I want to say I talked to him after that. What was it? He outscored the Nuggets through three. Or I'm sorry, the Mavericks through three quarters. He outscored the Mavericks through three quarters. I think I was talking to him around after that. And, you know, Michael's name came up. And I just remember him like, oh, man, the Michael comparison is so tired. You know, like, and I feel like he definitely came in with Michael as a template. And he was like going to out Michael. And then he realized, you know what, I'll never be able to out Michael. You know, let me maximize the Kobe here. And it'll just be better for everyone. But also, meanwhile, he's downloading information from Michael, right? Like their relationship became closer. You know, Michael signed off on him. And I think as the Kobe LeBron rivalry grew, I think Michael saw more of himself in Kobe than in LeBron, right? Yeah. So Kobe probably migrated to Kobe. And I think they became closer as Michael said, okay, I got to pick one. I'm going to pick the guy that's more like me. Reminds me of me. Yeah, yeah. I remember Michael telling me, I happened to be on the East Coast when Kobe was going on a run of like, you know, consecutive 40 and then 50 point games.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just happened to be on the East Coast and I went to a Wizards game and I'm asking Michael about it. Michael said, he's doing that thing that I did where he wants to separate himself from his peers. So, you know, for me, I want to separate myself, put distance between me and the Clyde Drexlers and the Barclays or whatever. He's that way now with like the McGrady's and the Iversons and the Vince Carters, right? He's like, I see that in him. That was the same way I was, right? And so kind of Michael signed off on that.
The
story, again, I've told this before, but I'll tell it again. The time Kobe told about that famous 98 All-Star game, right? In New York City.
The Laker boy.
Yeah, which we never knew. I wish I knew about Laker boy, you know, when I could have talked to Kobe about it. But that famous clip that we saw in The Last Dance, little Laker boy going to take all the shots. But what Kobe told me about that night was at one point, Michael says to him, he's like, hey, stay aggressive. You know, remember to stay aggressive. And Kobe said his first reaction was, let's talk about, of course I'm going to stay aggressive, you know? Like, he couldn't believe, it's like, stay aggressive, me? Like, this is me we're talking about. But as the season went on and as the years went on, Kobe realized, you know what? It's your third city in five nights, and you've been up all night getting treatment on your ankle. At that point, it's hard to stay aggressive, right? Everything is telling you, like, hey, you know, there'll be another game in a couple of days. You know, this is game 57 out of 82.
Right.
You know, hey, it's okay if you take the night. And what Kobe was like, no, it's not okay to take the night. And, you know, how many nights can you think of a Michael Jordan when he took the night off? How many nights can you think of with Kobe Bryant where he took the night? In fact, he was so consistent with his performance, I can name the two halves then he took off. A first half of a regular season game against Sacramento when he just didn't want to shoot. Why? Because his teammates had been complaining that he shot too much and he wanted to make a point on national TV
that.
On NBC against the Kings, remember?
Yeah.
I remember Stephen A. Smith calling me like, J.A., what is going on? You know, and then there was that second half against the Suns in game 7 where Kobe was just like, all right, I've been doing this all myself, you know, fine.
Y'all got it.
Right. He took like 2 shots, both 3-pointers at a time when he wasn't shooting a lot of 3-pointers. Like the shot chart was such an indictment because it was just like 2 shots like beyond the 3-point line in the second half. You know, that ain't Kobe. So that's it. Out of all the games he played, all the minutes, I can name 2 halves when I didn't feel like he was giving his max. So that's that lesson he took from Michael. All right, stay aggressive. And even he didn't understand the wisdom of it at first.
That he was
but
getting,
as
right.
he grew older and wiser, he recognized, like, oh, Mike dropped some knowledge on me. Like, it ain't easy. Only the greats can do it. That's what made Michael Michael. And he's like, if I adopt that mentality, you know, years before he called it the Mamba mentality. But I would say it was really originally the MJ mentality, because that's something, you know, I don't know if that's the main thing, but I know that's something that he took from Michael that he incorporated, and you saw the results.
My man, that is, look, there are so many different ways. Like, I wanted to ask about Kobe's future involvement in women's basketball. I wanted to ask about, you know, did he see Duncan or Shaq as his real rival? But that's all the time we got for today, because Jay's been dropping dimes and dropping knowledge all day. J.A., really appreciate you, my man.
Great to see you, man. Thanks, Benny.
Yes, sir. Thanks to producer Dakota and the entire team that works hard behind the scenes on this show. I'll be back Wednesday with another episode of The Good Word. Until then, everybody be safe.